About a month ago from Key West, I shared with all of you how I was going to start to live life a little more fully and how my intention moving forward was to also start talking a little more about work-life balance. You know, originally back in August of 19, a part of me wanted to make this podcast solely about this trade and utility business and only talk about this business. But I often made a sincere attempt to share others' journey with you and tie that to the business best I could. I hope that over the last year, we've kept your attention for those who live to work, but also presented option to those who work to live. I turned the big 5-1 last week, and what I've learned is that you can't mentally survive experiencing life through only one lens. I assure you that as I look back over the last 30 years in this business, I've given everything. I've given it my all. This trade's been so very good to all of us and provided particularly for me and my family like no other regular job could do. With that reward came hard work and sacrifice. This business is very consuming. There's no other way to put it, and the sacrifices are things that I've put off until a more convenient time simply never got done. I'm not talking about those odd jobs or honeydews around the house. I'm talking about the things in life where people close to you don't really need something to be fixed or built, but they need you, your attention, your time, most of all, your presence. This first episode with the new direction comes from me listening to an audiobook on Audible. Not sure if you've taken advantage of the offer on our website or not, but I highly encourage you to do so. We can talk about that later. The gentleman I sat down with today is a fellow Tennessean, and what started off as an interest to me has grown into simply an obsession. While I'm intrigued about the topic of Mount Everest and what I've missed in the whole experience of this book I'm going to talk to you about today is Mark Johnson and his wife Holly, or should I say Holly and her husband Mark, had a bucket list. A real list, mind you, and both of them kept it at the forefront of their daily life. What you're about to hear is how life often presents opportunities to us, and we're consumed with what we think is real life. Unless we're paying close attention, things often slip through our fingers in the matter of a few seconds. Listen to Mark share his story of his book, but most of all, listen for the few seconds of pure happenstance where Holly and Mark seize the moment and accomplish something few people will ever do. My hope is after you listen to this that you'll refocus your priorities, document your ambitions and goals, that you will be more attentive to your surroundings, but most of all, you will seize the moment when those opportunities present themselves. So get comfortable, get somewhere you can absorb this next hour without distractions, and walk with me as Mark Johnson shares his story and along the way takes us to Mount Everest. I have Mark Johnson, who is the author of Doofus Dad Does Everest Base Camp. Is that right, Mark?
That's right. That's it.
You've done another book too, right?
I have. It's called Blow the Man Down. It's kind of a prequel to Doofus Dad Does Everest Base Camp. They're both memoirs. The first one is more of a travel experience, as you know. And the first book is more of a travel experience. The second book is more of a memoir of my career in the music business in the 1990s leading up to when we went to Everest. So it gives you a sense of kind of how I got from point A to point B.
I told you a little bit ago how I listened to your book three times, starting on the fourth time this week. But at night, I'm a podcast junkie. I listen to talk radio a lot, but with the virus and politics and stuff, I try to steer clear of anything that fills me with more emotion, negative emotion, I guess, than what I have in my daily life already. So I look for things to occupy my mind. So one day I'm looking through podcasts and looking through different things and books and Google and stuff, and I stumbled upon your book on Audible. I have Audible as one of the sponsors of the show.
Okay.
You can get a free book, download books, etc. So I'm looking in Audible and I stumble across your book. So I download it. And as I mentioned earlier, you and I chatting before I pressed the record button. Jessica and I walk every morning and I started listening to your book. So here I am in Orlando, 4:30 in the morning, walking, listening to your book about being in Nepal and hiking to Everest Base Camp, and it just consumed me. Honestly, I couldn't stop listening to it. I caught myself listening to it probably sometimes when I shouldn't have been. I should have either been working, sleeping, eating, et cetera, but whatever. So, but anyway, so tell me a little bit about yourself before I get into the book. Tell me a little bit about yourself and who you are, where you live, your background, and then we'll move into the next part.
Sure. And let me say right off the bat that I'm honored that anybody would listen to my book two or three times. So very big thanks. And I'm honored to hear that. So I've had a bit of a Forrest Gump type life, to be honest with you. I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina. And when I was a kid, my dad was editor of Progressive Farmer magazine. And this was in the 60s. And anybody in the ag industry will recognize, if they've been in agriculture for a long time, they'll probably recognize the name of that magazine. And during his travels around the Southeast, he fell in love with the Christmas tree industry. And so he ended up buying a farm in the North Carolina mountains and started growing Christmas trees and selling Christmas trees down in Raleigh, North Carolina, again, when I was just a little kid. And that progressed to the point at which in the mid-70s, Dad moved our entire family from a 3,000 square foot suburban home into about a 700 square foot 100-year-old farmhouse way down in Ahala in the northwest mountains of North Carolina. And that really began an adventure for all of us, where my dad became instrumental in the development of Fraser fir Christmas trees on the east coast of the United States, and became really one of the pioneers in that industry. And my brother and sister and I, there's three of us, we grew up working in the fields, not only in Christmas trees, but in tobacco and sorghum molasses and strawberries and a few other things. But the Christmas trees was our main industry. And as I was doing that, you know, I had parents that really encouraged us to do well. They told us that we could do whatever we put our mind to and whatever we are willing to work for. I think that kind of got into all of us. Although my brother ended up staying in the ag industry with my dad, my sister went off to do other things. She got married and went off to have her life. And I got into the music business. So from about 1985 through about 1999, I was a singer-songwriter, musician, traveling musician. I played clubs and venues all over America and in the Caribbean. I thought for many, many years that was going to be what I did for the rest of my life. When I found my wife in the late 90s, we got married. About that coincided with me being a little burned out with traveling in the music industry. And as I mentioned before, my first book covers that whole lifestyle and that process. And the music industry has changed quite a bit over the past 20 years. It's changed drastically over the past 20 years. But I'll tell you, it is as much fun as it was, the big time Nashville industry could be really cutthroat and not particularly nice. By the late 1990s, I was ready to do something else. That led me to getting a position with Tennessee Farmers Cooperative in the early 2000s as a writer and an assistant editor for a big agricultural magazine. It was really weird. It was this circle of life type thing where when I got into my 30s, I started doing exactly what my dad had done when he was in his 20s and 30s. We were, you know, I was traveling around the state of Tennessee, interviewing farmers, writing stories, ag-based stories, and it was great. I love that. That went on for a decade. That led me to a position with the Tennessee Wildlife Federation as their communications director. And then that led into this crazy thing that I'm doing now that my wife and I do together, which is Hobnail Trekking Company and other various home-based businesses. So we've kind of become, after all these years, we've become entrepreneurs, writing these books and podcasting and blogging. All of that has been part of it. But it's been a long road to bring us to where we are. And, you know, what I've learned through this whole process is you have to be open to God's timing and pay attention to what he's putting in front of your face. When an opportunity is provided, you know, maybe you should follow it and go for it and see where it takes you. For us, it took us to the base of Mount Everest. That's kind of the nutshell right there.
Let's talk about that God's timing a second, because you started this business, Hobnail Trekking, and it was all just instantaneous, pretty much thought, thinking, or correct me if I'm wrong, from a rideshare one night. Was it Lyft or Uber one day?
Lyft,
you had your car in the shop or something. Can you tell that story, how that went down?
Well, and I have to back up a little bit too, to let you know what frame of mind we were in, or I was in when that happened. So Holly and I read a book called Into Thin Air by John Krakauer, which is a very famous Mount Everest climbing book.
Oh yeah.
It talks about the 1996 disaster on Mount Everest, and that became the movie Everest, or the movie Everest is based on that book. We just happened to read that in the early 2000s. Holly read it first, my wife, and I can still remember us sitting in bed, you know, her reading that, me reading something else, and her saying, honey, you have to read this book. As soon as I'm done, you're going to read this. This is crazy. This is just gripping, you know. And I knew nothing more about Everest than anybody else. No, I wasn't any kind of expert on that. So I read it, and just like her, I was just blown away by that book. And honestly, I thought that's where it was going to end. A few years later, she somehow found out that trekking to Everest Base Camp was a thing. That was something that people did. She came home and told me this one day, and she was like, we need to put that on our bucket list. That's something I would love to do that. I don't know what it would take or anything, but we need to put it on our bucket list. She actually had a physical bucket list, this cardboard thing, and she wrote it on there. Again, like a lot of people, people make a bucket list, but you never really seriously think that you're going to do the stuff that you put on your bucket list. It's more of an exercise, you know, but most people just are like, yeah, if I get rich, if I strike oil someday, I'm going to do that. But most bucket lists just fall by the wayside. Honestly, that's what I thought was going to happen with this. Then you fast forward to 2016. We took our kids to Disney World for the first big vacation we'd ever had. One of the days that we were there, we went to the Animal Kingdom. And at the Animal Kingdom, if you've ever been to Disney World, they have a Nepal area and an Everest roller coaster ride. And it was really fun. It was like our favorite roller coaster there. But in the process of standing in line for this, you're in an
it's amazing.
It's amazing. You're in a Nepal building, you know.
Yeah.
Holly and I were.
It's the only ride at Disney World that I enjoy waiting in line.
Oh my gosh. It is so cool. And
yeah,
we were equally as enthralled by the surroundings of that place as we were by the ride itself. So that got us fired up again about Nepal. So we come home, that was in February. In August of that year, my job at the Wildlife Federation had run its course, and I knew it, and I was ready to move on. I was actually applying to other communications positions. And this one night, I saw a listing for a communications position at Lyft, the rideshare company. So I applied for it. And by the way, I never got a call back. Be that it. So anyway, so I applied for it. The next day, the next morning, I dropped my old F-150 truck off at my mechanics. It needed some work. I took an Uber back to my office, which is about 2 miles away. And then that afternoon, they called and said, your truck's ready. So I decided to try Lyft because I thought, if I get called for an interview, I'm going to need to have some experience with the company.
They're going to ask you if you ever
exactly.
been in a Lyft before.
So this is a long story, but I'm telling you, all these pieces.
No, it's fine. It's a good story. I asked because I wanted you to tell me. I wanted to hear it. because you can't lie in an interview. You got to make it at least one time.
And I wasn't that big of an Uber guy either.
Exactly.
But I used Uber a few times. So I downloaded the Lyft app. I mean, all of this happened in 2 minutes. I downloaded the app and I hailed a ride. And I get the notification that the driver's coming. And it showed a little picture of a red Toyota car or something, or Nissan. And there was a name and it said Dawa Jangbu. And I thought, well, he ain't from around here. And I said, okay. So I walk outside. It says he's pulled up. So I walk out. There's a little red car, and the guy reaches over and opens the door. And I said, Dawa? And he said, Mr. Mark? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, you pronounced my name correctly. And that was our first meeting. So I sat down in the car. We had just less than 10 minutes to go. And during that trip, this guy, I'm asking him about Lyft, about the company Lyft, because I told him, hey, man, I applied for this job. Is it a good company to work for? Blah, blah, blah. And we just hit it off. He was super friendly, but it was clear that he had some kind of Asian ethnicity, but I couldn't tell from where, and his accent was really cool, but I couldn't distinguish what it was.
And see, if you had been like most of my friends who take Uber or Lyft, they would have either asked him and not been politically correct whether or not they had been picked up from drinking or not.
Right.
So you did good. You did good with refraining from that, I guess.
I got you. Yeah. And so we get there and he asked me if I liked my mechanic, because he was looking for a mechanic. And I said, yeah, they're great. I said, let me give them a reference. I'll let them know that you're going to call them, because I've known these people for a long time. And I needed a way to describe him to the mechanic shop. And I said, I was literally, Kenny, I was out of the car. I was out of the car and I was leaning in and I said, where are you from? And he said, Nepal. And I said, what? And I sat back down in his car and shut the door. And I said, you're from Nepal? And he said, yeah. And I said, do you know anything about the Everest Base Camp track? And he got this huge toothy smile on his face and looked at me and he said, Mr. Mark, I'm a Sherpa from the Everest region of Nepal. I've guided that trek dozens of times. You could have knocked me over with a feather. I was dumbfounded. And I said, Dawa, can we meet? And can you talk to my wife and I about this? He said, I'd be honored to do that. And he said, oh, I've got a call, or I've got another ride. I've got to go. Let's exchange numbers quickly. And we did. And he drove away. And within 30 seconds, I get a text that said, Mr. Mark, this is Dawa. Just wanted to say thank you. And here's my number, That was a Thursday. The next day, I left my job. And the next day, we met Dawa at a Starbucks in Nashville, Saturday. So all of these things fell into place that quickly. And I apologize to everybody who's listening. I know that was a long story. But when I tell this story, I want people to understand how important it is to, in my view, how important it is to follow up on opportunity when it's presented to you. Because that's the difference between all of this happening and none of it happening. Because if I would have not talked to him and not asked him where he was from, none of this would have ever happened.
So the moral of the story is every time I take an Uber, I need to ask people where they're from.
Exactly right.
And see where that, I need to.
It might not work out the same way every time.
I need to scan my bucket list before I take an Uber or Lyft and make sure just to see if.
That's right.
Are you from Anguilla? Oh, awesome. That one's on here. Yeah. Do you have any family there I could stay with like in 5 years for the rest of my life?
Right. Do you happen to be a professional guide, for some great trip?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That is, so that's an awesome story. So at that time when you and Holly, and it sounds like you guys are definitely more than life partners, you guys are business partners.
Yep.
I mean, you do everything together.
Yep.
So at that point, moving forward in your mind, you guys were going to Nepal at some point in time.
When we left the meeting with him that Saturday, we walked out. I'll never forget. As we were walking through the parking lot out to our car after meeting with Dawa, Holly and I said, okay, we're doing this. We're going to go in the spring of 2018. and we have no idea how. We have no idea how we're going to afford it, what we're going to do with our three kids, what we're going to do about jobs. We're making a commitment. We're going, period. And that's what we did. And so at that point, we were just planning on going as customers of Dawa, because Dawa, we found out, had his own small trekking company based in Kathmandu. But he was in America a lot of his family had immigrated to Tennessee over the past 30 years. And he was here both to work and to, you know, learn the culture of America and to promote trekking in Nepal. So when we left that meeting, we were just going to be his customers. And then over the next about 6 months, I started scheming about, wait a minute, we could actually make a company, because I did some research and found that there was no company based east of Colorado that provided Everspace Camp treks. They were all on the West Coast. And I thought, well, why do just the West Coast people get to have all the fun? I mean, and there's bound to be Southern people that would love to do something like this, and they would rather deal with another Southern person than they would with somebody out in California or in Europe or in Kathmandu. And also, I had the advantage of being able to build websites and do photography and write and stuff. So I knew that I could make the foundation of the company myself. And then with Dawa's partnership, you know, I knew that I could partner with him and he could handle all of the trekking stuff that I knew nothing about. But Holly and I could handle the administrative stuff here in America, and we would be the people that people would talk to and communicate with. So it just was I thought it was a cool idea, and Holly got excited about it. Dawa was excited because he had no way to really market his company here. So it just worked out really well. We launched Hobnail Trekking in January of 2017.
And just for the listeners, of course, I've been a Mount Everest freak since I was a kid. I don't know why I've just been consumed by it. But for the listeners, you know, I've heard people talk about Everest Base Camp, and they're like, when I first heard about it, I didn't realize, you know, the elevation of the base camp. So for the listeners, I lived in California. I lived right outside of Fresno, which,
right,
I don't know, it was probably less than 75 to 100 miles from Mount Whitney, which is the tallest mountain in the contiguous United States. So the tallest mountain in the United States, as we know it, excluding Alaska and Hawaii, is 14,505 feet, I believe, is what Mount Whitney is. Everest Base Camp is what?
17,600 feet.
Yeah, so the base camp of Everest is higher elevation-wise, above sea level, than any place we have in the contiguous United States. I just want to kind of put that in perspective when you're talking about going to Everest Base Camp and what it means.
And not only is it higher, it's way higher. You know, you're talking about 3,000 feet, which is the height of, you know, most mountains on the East Coast or on the Eastern. So it's a drastically higher. And when you start also, just for context, when you start the walking part of the trek, you start at 9,300 feet. You're starting
twice as high as Mount LeConte, almost.
Right.
In Tennessee.
You're starting high, too. That's right.
I wanted to give you some kudos about your book a second. One thing you do very well in your book is I'm a wordsmith, a word freak. My team, my employees, friends will tell you there's another name they give that as far as me and my words. But I listen a lot, and people, like, sometimes I call people out and say, no, you didn't say it could, you said should, or you didn't say might, you said will.
Right.
I listen, words mean a lot.
Right.
And listening to your book, I'll be honest with you, I listened to a lot of the beginning of your book when you touched on your music a little bit, and you touched on meeting Dawa. But man, when you got on the plane in Nashville, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it was like 4:30 Nashville time. It's what you said in the book, if I'm not mistaken, or something like that. I was glued, and just your descriptive words of, and I lived in California, had family in Tennessee. After I went through divorce, moved out there, worked for the utility out there. So I made that trip many times from either Nashville, Chattanooga, Atlanta, Charlotte to LA, and then connected back to Fresno. Mm-hmm. When I was listening to you, I was tired. Like, I honestly, I felt like I was actually flying to LA, because we did the LA trip late one night from Orlando, and then we did Honolulu the next morning, and I got to spend the night in a hotel in LA. Uh-huh. You just got off one plane right on the next and went to China. And when you talked about being the flight attendants, right, is a funny story. So I don't want to tell the whole, I want people to download your book and listen to it. But you talking about the flight attendants is pretty funny. And then, when you land in Nepal in Kathmandu, you get in the wrong line. I'm terrified with you guys. Like, this happened 3 years ago, right? And I'm listening to this book, and I am like, because I don't know what it is about me, but I like lines and waiting and all, and not knowing and trying to get in the right. You guys waited in the wrong line to get your visa for 45 minutes and worked it all out. So I came to the conclusion with one thing. I'm going to be a customer of yours at some point in the future. Jessica and I have already talked about it. We're going.
Well, that's fantastic.
But so I'm going to need like step by step with pictures and everything just to get me to Lukla.
Well,
I'm telling you.
I'll tell you that that whole experience gave us all the ammunition that we needed for the information that we need to provide to our clients. And, you know, just so the listeners know, when we went with a group of about 15 Americans, and it was the inaugural trip of Hopnail Tracking Company. So although we had all of Dawa's expertise, we had none of our own other than the research we had done. So, and not only that, we weren't world travelers at all, period. You know, I know a lot of people that travel all over the world, and they're used to airports. They're used to crazy immigration lines. They don't freak out. They don't stress about it. I'm not like that. I'm the worst. I'm fairly used to flying in the United States, but when I, you know, if it's a little bit out of the ordinary, I get a little nervous. And so that whole airport thing, what we do now is we have a little graphic of the airport, and we give everybody this. It's a PNG image that they put on their phones so that when they land in Kathmandu, they can get their phone out, they can open up that graphic, and they can literally follow the arrows, and they, you know, they'll know, for the most part, they're going to know what to do. And that's all because of our experience. Yeah.
Y'all were the test run, I guess you might say. You worked out all the bugs.
We were the test dummies.
In Kathmandu, just a couple things. Yeah. The first thing was there's actually three things that I remember specifically. One was the don't touch the monkeys at the monkey temple. The second one, I've actually Googled, and I watched your videos on YouTube as well, but the second one is where they had the altar where they actually cremated they like inside the temple, and it's like an outdoor courtyard type thing. That's the second thing that people really should take a look at your videos and look at. Kathmandu is a very interesting place. And then the third one, that one I have to applaud you on, is one of y'all's employees, after you guys had a meal, took you into an art gallery. And you stayed there, and then come to find out that person actually was getting a cut, and you're like, we're done at this point. I mean, you like ended the relationship, and those are the three things about Kathmandu that I remember, because that's one of the fears that I always have. Like, I've been on one cruise in my life, and that was like three years ago. That's it. And the one thing that I feared, and I heard horror stories about, is every port of call where you go on an excursion, you're going to get money, 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 money all the time. And so that's So I applaud you for that. That is that's huge, a huge worry of people, you know. So
Yeah, just gonna say that a Kathmandu, it has its touristy areas, and the temples that you're referring to, when you're you know, all the people that live there, they know that the tourists are going to come to the temples. So they set up outside the temples. Sometimes they set up in the temples. So when you go into these things, you will be approached by people that want to sell you things. It was fairly rare that we were approached by people that just wanted money. That's, you know, we're like begging for money, but you'll get a lot of people that'll come up and offer to sell you something.
We call that Disney here in Orlando. Right. We do call that Disney.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
You know, what you do is you be polite and friendly to people, but you be firm and you say no, and you move on, and you never give money to anybody, because if you do, it'll literally create a little riot, you know, of people that are, and you'll find kids more than often, more likely than not, it's going to be kids that are going to ask for money. And, you know, you just have to look at them and smile and say, and you will experience incredible poverty in Kathmandu, like nothing you've ever seen. And it's heartbreaking. You just have to pray for those people and just move on, because there's nothing that you're going to be able to do for them that's going to get them out of that situation. You know, we like that, if nothing else, you know, we're helping to provide a little bit of income to the Nepali economy by sending people over there to experience. And, you know, it's not just Mount Everest, but Kathmandu is an amazing city. It is just the coolest thing ever. And the people in general are wonderful, and they're so nice, and they're so welcoming and friendly, helpful. I can't say enough about it. I never felt threatened in any way. And I'm also like twice as big as most of the people over there. So I doubt that anybody was going
to. Yeah. Well, see, I'm not. I would fit right in. I may like to go. I'm 5'6". So I would fit right in.
Right. Well, you would fit in better than me, sure.
So I may move to Kathmandu. I may move there.
And not to get ahead, but I'll tell you that the tea houses over there were definitely not built for me.
Oh,
I was hunched over most of the time that I was walking through the hallways.
That's great. So when you leave Kathmandu, you go to the airport, you fly to Lukla, which is, I think, specifically named the most dangerous airport in the world. It's like built on the runway itself is built on the side of a mountain. Is it? Yep. I mean, I've watched the videos, and like you've said throughout your audiobook that I've listened to, and I really appreciate you being the reader of the book. I do several Audible books, and they're very hard to listen to when it's not the people that are actually
wrote it,
you know, the book's about or whatever. Yeah, they wrote it. You describe like seeing the valley and everything. So, but the airport specifically, is it as scary as you thought it was going to be, or is it? I mean, it wasn't for
us. We flew out on a day that was just absolutely picture perfect. The weather was fantastic. We had no turbulence. Just so that your listeners know, you know, when you fly into Kathmandu, you can see the Himalayas off in the distance to the north. And, but the Kathmandu Valley is just a big flat open place. So, but when you fly from Kathmandu to Lukla, which is about a 45-minute flight, you are flying into the Himalayas, and you're on a plane that is made specifically for that flight. You're flying with mountaintops that are way above you when you're getting in there. So that's something that I never really experienced before. You would experience that with a helicopter, but not with a plane. All of us were, that plane was just our team. And we were all oohing and eyeing and flipping out the whole time. It was one of my favorite parts of the whole trip was that flight. And when we landed, I mean, it's a little freaky. The thing that makes it freaky is that the end of the runway is a cliff. It's not like a runway where there's a big grassy area that you pass over before your wheels hit the pavement. It's a cliff. The plane has to land right after it passes over that cliff edge, because it doesn't have a lot of distance to slow down. And the other part of it is there's no touch and go. That's what makes it.
It's like the side. It's like the side of the mountain. There's only one way in.
There's one way in,
one way out. Right.
All right. There's no. You can't decide that you want to do it again and take off again, because the runway ends in the side of a mountain.
Wow.
All that said, the pilots are highly trained, and they have to be. They've got to go through a big process to get certified to do it, and that's the only thing they do all day long, as they go back and forth from Lukla to Kathmandu. They're skilled people. The reason, I guess, that it's called the most dangerous airport in the world is just because it is compared to other typical airports, it's pretty extreme. But there have been crashes, but not all that many. There's been a few.
Right. Margin of error, I guess,
right,
is a little different than landing at, say, in Orlando or
right,
you know, somewhere else. I know. Going into San Francisco, you fly over the bay and land, you know, the runways at the
right,
end. That's
right.
The one I think about a lot of times right there. Mm-hmm. So one thing that surprised me when you guys landed in Lukla, you got your stuff and you were gone. Y'all like had tea and y'all left. I mean,
yep.
I'm thinking you get there, you get a hotel or you settle in for the day. You know, you look around a little bit, but you guys had mm-hmm. your backpacks on and were gone.
Yeah, the day starts early. Usually you're going to be up before 5 o'clock at Kathmandu. So if you can get the first flight or one of the first flights in the morning, then you're going to have plenty of time to get there and take off and get to your first village. One of the advantages for us is that our network of Sherpas is very well connected in both Kathmandu and on the trail. We usually can get the best flights, because we have those, our guys have the contacts to make it happen.
Okay.
But you're right. You land in Lukla. We take about an hour to set up, get ready to get last minute snacks and sunscreen and things like that. And to meet, if you're with a big team, that's where you'll meet your additional Sherpas and your yak man. So the guy that is actually handling the yaks that will be carrying the heavy stuff. That's where you're going to meet everybody, and then you're going to take off. It's pretty swell. I tell you, it's pretty exciting. If you go to our YouTube channel, you know, there's video of us leaving. I mean, I had my phone on, my camera, my GoPro was filming from when we walked out of that tea house and took our first steps onto the trail. And, we were pretty pumped.
Is that the GoPro that you just had put on a brand new on the gimbal and had left in the hotel?
Yep.
And Kathmandu?
Yeah.
That's me. That's
oh my gosh.
You're going to think I'm a freak, cause I, like I say, I remember details, but your Life Straw water bottle, I was going to ask you if you ever think about what happened to that. Yeah. You never
got another one.
Brand new one.
Somebody got a $40 brand new Life Straw bottle, brand new. I was so ticked off, man. And it's still, thanks for reminding me, Kenny.
Yeah. I wanted to make sure that during this conversation that I brought that up, because you said in the book that it still bothers you. So I just wanted to,
right.
I didn't want that memory to die.
Right.
So
well, I appreciate
that. So as you move up the valley, of course, you're moving higher elevation the entire time, and you go through numerous villages, and I don't remember the names of all of them, but I do remember Namche Bazaar. Is that's the way you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so I told you I'm an Everest freak. So I've listened to several books I almost said books on tape, and I guess that's not 2020-ish anymore. they're not on tape anymore, but audio books.
Right.
And one of the ones I finished recently was about the 1953 trek of the British, when Edmund Hillary and Tenzing actually went, you know, summited Mount Everest. Mm-hmm. And so Namche Bazaar was like a huge center for all those operations from the Swiss and the English. So is it? It's a pretty big place, I guess.
Yeah, it's the Sherpa capital. I don't know if it's
okay
officially, if they officially have a capital, but it's referred to as the Sherpa capital. And it's not only a village, and it's not only a big village, but it's an amazing village. I encourage anybody that's listening to go Google Namche Bazaar. Bazaar as in like a place where you buy things. B-A instead of B-I. It's built in it's a cone shape valley that's kind of been, I don't even know exactly how to describe it. It's when you enter Namche Bazaar, you're entering from the low end of it. And then you're looking up, and it's a bowl shape. That's what I was trying to say. You're looking up at a bowl shape valley that's in the side of a mountain, and spread out all through this bowl are buildings. And they're brightly colored buildings, a lot of blues and greens. And most all of those are tea houses or restaurants or shops and residences. It's all above you. It's way up high above you. And it's unlike anything you've ever seen. The whole place is terraced. So the only way that they can survive, both with their farming and their building of villages, is to terrace these hillsides. So they've got flat places to build structures on. For anybody that goes, I'll warn you that's the second day. And by the time you get to Namche Bazaar, you are going to be a wiped out person. That is one of the longest and toughest treks of the entire trip. And when you get to the bottom of it, you're like, yes, we made it. Thank you, Lord. We can sit down now. No, unless your tea house is one of the first tea houses right there, you've got to walk up you're hoofing up through the town on a staircase that takes you from top to bottom. I don't know how long. It probably took us 25 minutes to walk from the entrance of Namche to get to our tea house up that staircase. So it's,
you mentioned in your book that most of the tea houses that you had on your trek were always at the far end of the town.
It makes it a little tough. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's an advantage in the next morning, right? You're already through the town, but yeah, at the end of the day, that makes it tough. Jessica she likes to take the stairs everywhere we go instead of the elevator. And we'll drive down to Key West, you know, 6.5 hours from here. We're in the car. We'll get to the hotel, 4 stories. And she's like, you want to take the stairs? I'm like, are you kidding me?
Right.
You want to take the stairs? No, I want you to put me on that luggage car and take me to the room on the first floor. I don't want to walk
exactly
anymore. You know,
one thing that I didn't anticipate was the amount of steps and stairs. And it's not just in the villages; it's very crude stairs and steps are built with stone all along the trail to base camp. So you're stepping up using crude staircases a lot. So if I would have known that before we went the first time, you know, I would have spent more time on a Stairmaster. And that'd be a great way to train, or go into athletic stadiums and just, you know, running or walking stairs. That's the way to do it.
I had read or listened to somebody talking about going to do the Everspace Camp, and they said that if you really want to prepare yourself, go to a hospital or a office building that has a 4 or 5 story yep. parking garage and park at the top
yep.
and then run the stairs mm-hmm. even if you walk them, because you're not going mm-hmm. to, even with yep. that, you're probably not going to prepare yourself for what you're going to have to endure on this trip. So you leave Lucco on day 2, and then it's another 2 days before you get there, right? You spend the night somewhere, and then you end up at Namche, and then in Namche Bazaar, you guys do 2 or 3 days there for acclimatization?
We do. We've changed that recently to add a second day at Namche. So what'll happen is you'll get there one day, and you'll just relax once you get there. The next day, you'll do a training hike way up above the village, and you'll go do some cool things. You'll come back the next day. You'll do the same thing. You won't necessarily go to the same place, but you'll take another training hike, come back and sleep. And then the third day from that, you'll take off. So Namche is at just below 12,000 feet. 12,000 is generally the area where you need to start your acclimatization process, which is, you know, building more red blood cells in your blood by putting your body at a higher altitude for a short amount of time and then coming back. So if you've read anything about climbing Everest, most people know that when you climb Everest, you don't just start at the bottom and go all the way up. You start to the next camp and you stay there for a while, for a little while, and then you go back down. And then the next time you go to the next camp for a little bit, and then you go up to the one above that, stay for a while, and then come back. So that whole process is about acclimatization and building the red blood cells in your system so that you can better utilize the oxygen you get.
And for climbing Everest, I think it takes like 5 or 6 weeks. They're there at base camp for over a month, I think, and they go, like you said, back and forth through the different camps to the summit.
Yep.
I don't know. I just find it so intriguing. After you leave, and like I said, I don't want to talk about your whole book on here, but just some high points. The day, I think it's maybe the day after you leave Namche is the first time you see the Big E. You see Everest for the first time. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
What was it?
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, you said in the book, you mentioned that at the time you didn't, you're just kind of like, your mind is trying to process all this stuff. You're in a foreign country. 2 days ago, you were here. Now you're here. Now you're getting farther away from civilization. So your mind's trying to process all this stuff. And then you see Everest for the first time. And while you're there, it's a big deal, but it's like, it is, but it's not. But later on, reflecting back on it, you realize what a big deal it really was at that time. So just for the listeners, reflecting back on that, what is it like?
I would say that anybody that's going over there probably has had some interest in Everest at some point. I was no different, and I'd read about it, and I'd watched dozens of documentaries and movies and stuff. But the thing about, you hear about Mount Everest from first grade or something. Mount Everest, just the word, is something that's ingrained into every American psyche from the time you're a little kid. There are a lot of things like that that you never get to see in person. When you actually see Mount Everest with your own two eyes, it's almost impossible to really process it right then. It's just kind of amazing. You see this, there it is. You know, you see this peak and you see the snow blowing off the top and everything. And it's just impossible to really process it then. And I'll say too, that the entire trip for me, speaking for myself, the entire thing is difficult to process. It's so unlike what you're used to if you're an American that the whole thing feels like a dream. I encourage people, anytime you do anything out of the ordinary, go to, you know, some beautiful Caribbean island or to some incredible mountain, be sure that you take the time to stop and consciously say to yourself, this is happening. This is a pivotal moment of my life, and don't ever forget this moment. And that's what I did. Everybody was kind of stunned in our group. One thing that's interesting is I went back and did some interviews with our group 6 months later, after we returned. I asked everybody about that moment and what they thought about it. And Kenny, I'm telling you, at least two or three of the people broke down into tears when they,
wow,
yeah, they were so moved by it, they couldn't even talk.
I guess the one time I've been like that is, have you ever been to Hawaii?
I never have, no. Mm-mm.
I was fortunate enough to go Thanksgiving 2017, I guess. And we left LA one morning, Friday morning, you know, 6 or 7 a.m., and we landed in Honolulu. And you get to Honolulu, and it is nothing like you think it is. It is a city. That's all I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. One of the first things we did was we went to Pearl Harbor.
Right.
You walk into this room, and, you know, it's still like, you know, I spent a lot of time on the West Coast, San Francisco. I've been to Seattle, San Diego, L.A., and the Pacific has the same feel no matter what town you're in. It's kind of, you got a cool breeze, you know, all the buildings are similar, architecture, everything.
Mm-hmm.
So Honolulu has that feel to it.
Right.
But you walk in and you watch this black and white video and this video about Pearl Harbor. And then you walk out this door and you're on a military base, you're on a military installation, and you get on a U.S. Navy boat with soldiers taking you out to, you know, the Pearl Harbor Memorial, the Arizona Memorial. And when you, like, people are talking and stuff in the movie, and it's tourists, right?
Right.
The minute you walk out that door and get on that boat, it is like no one's talking. It's quiet. You get on the boat, you ride out to the Arizona, and that moment So that's probably the only time I can remember mm-hmm. in my life that exactly what you're describing. It's like you've heard about it. You're there. You're at Pearl Harbor and know that, you know, 80 years ago what went down.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's just, so I follow, when you mentioned that in the book, I was thinking,
yep.
you know, when in my life have I ever experienced that? It's this, that's the only time I can think of, honestly.
I've got a great uncle who is still on the Arizona, who died on the Arizona and is still on it today.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I've got a connection to it out there.
Wow.
Yeah.
You got to go. You got to go. And when you're there and you're looking over the rail, and you can see the crude, yeah. the oil, the fuel bubbling up into the ocean. It is just, it's yeah. amazing. I encourage anybody to go if you get a chance to. It's pretty amazing. But anyway, I haven't talked about her a lot, but Holly's with you. Y'all mm-hmm. are business partners, been married a long time, got three kids.
Mm-hmm.
She decided to take this trek 2 months after she had knee surgery.
Yep.
What was she thinking?
Yep.
It's funny because I didn't catch this the first time. And I don't know if it was because mm-hmm. when we were walking in the neighborhood, you know, I told you I listened to your book when we were walking in the neighborhood. I don't know if Jessica was talking to me or if a, you know, car was coming or what. I missed the part where she goes to the doctor and you talk to her and say, look, you know, I don't think you should go or whatever. And she kind of shuts you down and says, we'll talk about it when we get home. And then y'all have a little family right. meeting, and the words that she used, you said bleep, 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 I'm going. That's right. pretty much, you pretty much knew at that point she was going, no matter yeah. what. And so you guys are together, and I love the stories. And like I say, it's so hard for me not to give it all away, but staying in the tea houses and some of the things that you encounter, you know, you locked her in the room, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it's hilarious. Yeah. I can relate to so much of what you guys experience. That's like every vacation that Jessica and I go on, honestly.
There's a reason why I blog under the name Doofus Dad.
Doofus Dad,
and the name
Dad,
of the book
yeah.
is Doofus Dad.
And it's hilarious, and I can relate to it so much. And you guys, you make it up, you know, it's like, what, day 10 before you make it to Everest Base Camp. Is that right?
Actually, that's day 8.
Day 8, okay.
Yep.
The way you describe it in the book with the lower oxygen, I found myself physically having, like, not difficulty breathing, but, like, I was trying to imagine. Of course, I'm walking at 4:30 in the morning in Orlando in the summertime. The humidity is 100%, so the air is mm-hmm. pretty thick, you know, and so I'm having problems breathing anyway.
Right.
I'm listening to you talk about it. Is it scary at all? I mean, can you catch your breath, or I mean, did your body get used to it? Or, and that's for my own benefit. That's honestly because I'm going and I just need to know this.
Well, I was really interested to see how I would react to what you're talking about. And we talk about this in the book. We took a medicine called Diamox, which is the high altitude medicine. It's a preventative and it's a medication for high altitude sickness. We were on a Diamox regimen, and the altitude really didn't bother us that much. As a matter of fact, everybody in our group was on Diamox except for two guys. And one of the guys was an older man who was on a different type of regimen. And then the other person was a young guy who was probably the most fit, or one of the most fit people in the group. Is a young, you know, athletic guy in great shape, you know, the kind of guy that you and I would be disgusted by. And he refused to take it. And he's the guy that got sick. He pushed himself too hard and was always out front and was always leaving the rest of us behind and stuff. And he went against the recommendations of the Sherpas. And he got sick. Now, he wasn't, you know, deathly ill, but he got sick for a couple of days and then started taking Diamox, and then he stayed on it for the rest of the time. When we were at base camp, I wasn't scared. I wasn't worried. Now, we were in just south of a blizzard, I would say. I mean, when we walked into base camp, it was snowing very heavily and the wind was blowing, and that was pretty intense, but we weren't afraid. I was at that point, my biggest concern was worrying about Holly and her knees. and getting her to the to Gorikshep, which is the last little village before you get to base camp. The next morning, when I went up Kalapatar, which is a small little peak that's beside Gorikshep, beside the village, that you don't have to be a climber to get up at. You, it's a walk, it's a hike, but it's the place where most people go try to summit Kalapatar and get amazing photography of Mount Everest. It's the best place to see the summit of Everest. And that morning, which was the morning after we were at base camp, myself and Dawa went out, just me and him, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was probably about 10 degrees. It was very windy and it was snowing. My little headlamp was only illuminating this little tiny circle in front of my feet. And when I started up Kalapatar, that's when I really felt the altitude. And that's when I wasn't frightened, but I was like, oh yeah, okay. Now I get it. Now I feel it. Because I would take 10 steps and would have to stop and catch my breath and you know, take a little break and then take another 10 steps. That was the big moment for me. But no, I never got really sick. I was tired and I didn't feel great. Actually, that particular morning was probably the worst day for me until I got sinus infection later on, which I talk about in the book. But the altitude didn't really bother me. Except for that one time.
The way I understand it, it's a lot, it's really rocky. And I think of poor Holly, she pushed through and made it to Everest Base Camp.
She did.
Yeah, that's.
She did. And without giving it all away, I'll tell you that when we go, we haven't since COVID hit, we haven't done personal appearances with the book, but for a while there, we were going and I was doing readings and signing the books and stuff. People didn't want to meet me. Right. They want to meet Holly.
Of course. She's the hero of the
book. Holly's the hero.
She's the hero,
book,
of course.
Me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No, I get that. Yeah. 100%.
Yep.
You know, and if you don't mind, the one thing you mentioned earlier about the tea houses, your company actually lines all that up, like tea houses, meals, all that stuff. The only thing that's really not included, my understanding, is the tips for the Sherpas and all that. And you guys help with calculating all that, let you know what the costs are up front, and then your transportation to Kathmandu, right?
Right, and that has just from a practical standpoint, our pricing has changed, and we will be releasing those prices within the next month. Really, that'll be our 2021 and 22 pricing, and I'll just tell you that it's a little cheaper. A little better.
How many days? And I know that the trek is, I think, is it 15? It's 20? Is it 3 weeks total or 2 weeks? I can't remember.
You want to block out 20 days.
20 days. Yeah. You guys left on a what? Tuesday?
I can't.
Tuesday night?
Probably so.
I think it was a Tuesday. Yeah. Tuesday night. You got there on Friday morning because you lose a day going.
Right.
But you get it back coming back. But I was trying to. So Jessica and I were just talking about vacation and, you know, what we would have to do. We have a 16 and a 14-year-old that are in great shape, soccer, lacrosse. Would you recommend something like that for teenagers?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. We generally don't recommend anybody younger than about 12 to do it. Only because it's mentally tough. It's a mental.
Right.
Thing, you know, and a lot of kids, unless they've grown up hiking and you camping and doing that sort of thing, they might have a tough time when it gets tough. Now, there are periods where you're crisscrossing up through the woods back and forth on a trail that, you know, you look up and you see people way up above you, little ants way up above you, and you think, I got to go all the way up there. And that's when you got to be mentally tough and push through. But Kenny, we saw there was a 10-year-old kid at base camp when we walked in, because I talked to him and asked him how old he was. People of any age pretty much can do it. I just wouldn't recommend it until you're at least 13 or so.
Yeah. Well, by the time we go, they'll be 17 and 15 and we'll hate our guts and not want to do anything with us anyway. So it'll be much cheaper, you know.
Right.
Yeah. The 10-year-olds at places like that don't bother me. What bothers me most of the time is when you're huffing and puffing doing something and an 80-year-old passes you. That's what really bothers me. Jessica and I, we did a 5K here in Orlando, and I'm like almost to the end, and it's the first one we ran, and I'm ready to give up. And she's like, "You got this, don't worry," you know. And we were almost to the finish line, and this literally 81-year-old person, this man, passed me. Cause I looked up, I looked him up to see, cause he crossed before I did. And had I known that he had beat me by, you know, he left after I did because it was from start to finish, you know, I would have tripped him. I'm serious. I would have tripped the guy, because I can't, but that's embarrassing. But the man, some of those people, I was reading a statistic, you know, when you tailor your Google or whatever to pull up, articles. And today there was an article about, your chances of hiking to the summit of Everest have increased because of the technology and the weather and the oxygen and the planning and all this. And it was talking about that a person 60 years old has the same survival chance and a chance to ascend and top Everest as somebody 40, which I thought was, it put in parentheses, 60 is the new 40 is what it said. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Right.
But,
well, I'll tell you something that I discovered when I was training, because we had some medical people that went with us. When you have altitude sickness, which is the big problem up there, your brain swells. And what I learned was people that are 50 and above are a lot less likely to get altitude sickness because their brains have shrunk and they've got more room in their skull for their brain to expand.
I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm perfectly fine because my 16-year-old tells me all the time that I turned 51 Monday.
Oh, happy
this
birthday.
Week. Thank you. And she tells me that I'm already in the shrinking stage. So I was 5'6", so I need to probably measure, see if I'm 5'5" now. But I think it has a lot to do with her getting taller, and she doesn't, you know, she likes to just say that I'm shrinking.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a lot of room up here in my head. So I'm good. I'm glad you said that.
Well, and
I feel safe now.
I'll tell you one quick other story that you probably remember from the book, but I was getting passed constantly by people, you know, by older people. And more than that, you're constantly being passed by Sherpas that are carrying, you know, maybe 150 pounds of gear on their back. And they pass you like you're standing still. Those people are
incredible.
They are supermen. It's
That's
unbelievable
incredible.
To watch. There was one day when I was approaching Lobachay, which is way up high, and I thought I was doing pretty good. I was doing well. I had my trekking poles, and I was getting after it. And I heard something come up around me, and this guy passed me like I was standing still. And I looked down and he had two prosthetic legs. Well, when I first looked at him, my first thought was that guy's at least 10 years older than me. And he's wearing a short sleeve shirt. I'm bundled up in all kinds of stuff. And this guy passed me, he's wearing a short sleeve shirt. And then I looked down and he's got two metal legs. And that turned out to be a guy named Mark Inglis, who is a famous mountaineer from either New Zealand or Australia. I'm not sure. I think New Zealand. He's the first double amputee that's ever summited Everest. He was amazing. And then a day later, when we walked into base camp, he walked in at the same time. And I went over and talked to him at that time. But when he passed me, I was like, I was tempted to reach out and trip him. he ticked me off.
Yeah,
so much.
That is when you're struggling and everything. So, I was going to ask you earlier about the tea houses and stuff. They're not hotels by any means, but it's not tent camping. You have beds. You go into the details a little more in your book, but your YouTube videos, you and Holly do a really good job with your YouTube videos.
Thank you.
Explaining a lot of things. And I promise you, Jessica and I are going to be customers of yours hopefully in 21. But if not, definitely in 22. And, I'm excited. I can't wait. And I'm probably going to call you personally and ask at least 3,000 more questions before this is over with.
Well, you're welcome to anytime. And I welcome anybody else that has an interest in this to reach out to us, go to Our website, hobnailtrekkingco.com. That's H-O-B-N-A-I-L, trekkingco.com. We named that after the hobnail boot, which was the preferred footwear of climbers from the Roman days all the way up to about 1950. And that's when the technology changed. So we wanted to name our company something that was a throwback to the climbing and hiking days of old.
I did not realize that. That's one thing I was going to ask you, and I forgot to ask you where the name came from. That's very
interesting. That's it. But we love to talk about trekking. We're about as normal as anybody you're ever going to meet that own a Himalayan trekking company. We don't, you know, the income part of it is not great. What we're trying to do is provide this experience to as many other people as we can, because we know how awesome it is. And we also know that there's a lot of logistics and planning and stuff that's involved. And our goal was to make that as easy as we possibly could for people that want to do this trek, and for us to help you prepare in every way that we can. That's our goal.
Well, I can tell you that, like I said, I've enjoyed the book tremendously. Mark Johnson, Doofus Dad Does Everest Base Camp. It's a good read, good listen. I appreciate you taking the time. You know, the fact that in the book that you, and I don't know what the right word is, overlaid or edited in your videos, the sound in certain times of the books, like when you talk about the bells mm-hmm. of the yaks, you hear the bells, or when you're crossing the Hillary Bridge or kids mm-hmm. or whatever, your book takes you there. And I just can't tell you enough how much I enjoyed it. And I'm sure that the people that are going to download this that are my listeners are going to enjoy it as well. A lot of my listeners spend a lot of time in their vehicles going to and fro, crossing the country and stuff. And so this is going to be...
One thing I want to mention, Kenny, too, is that I've worked in the cooperative world since 2003. And I'm a member of a group called the Cooperative Communicators Association, which is a national trade group of cooperative communicators. And over those years, rural electric co-op people have become some of my best friends. And I've been exposed to that process, and I've heard a lot about linemen and what they go through and what they deal with. So I have a little more knowledge about electric line workers and people in that industry than normal people might. And I really appreciate everybody that works in that field and what you do, because, you know, we realize that when the crap hits the fan, that it's you guys that are out there on the front lines getting us back into business. And we really do appreciate it.
Well said. Well said. A lot of people don't appreciate it until the lights go out, and then that's when the crap does hit the fan.
Right.
So thank you for that.
You bet. I'll tell you too, Kenny, that Holly and I are going to start a Himalayan trekking podcast soon.
Oh, awesome.
And
I cannot wait.
It won't be our other podcasts are kind of just indeterminate. We're going to do them as long as we want to, but it'll probably be about 15 episodes, and each episode will cover a different aspect of, you know, the travel, the food, the training, the gear. You know, each episode will be a different topic. We'll get them all done and put them out there hopefully within the next couple months.
I'm definitely looking forward to that. And I'm going to go back and get your other book as well.
Good. Yeah. Good.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Again, Mark Johnson, Doofus Dad Does Everest Base Camp. You can find it in bookstores, Amazon, and on audible.com. And I'm sure they would appreciate it. And you will, this guy takes you to Everest Base Camp. You will, whether you're driving, lying in bed, walking in the neighborhood on the treadmill, you will feel like you're there. Much appreciated, Mark. And you're going to hear from me soon. And I'm going to give you some of my money, and I'm going to experience it firsthand. So thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you, man. It's good talking to you.
All right, you too.